Very happy to be here. So I'm thankful to Chris and to Lucian who have made it possible for me to come and give this talk. It should be about MUBs and HADAMARDs. And we should start with this, which stands for mutually unbiased basis. These sets of bases have got a lot of attention the last years. On the archive since year 2000, there is more than 100 papers that mention them in the abstract. One place where they are interested is in quantum information. And I actually think the first place where someone discusses a set of several such mutual unbiased bases is in Wiesner's paper, conjugate coding. Another area where they are interested and where I'm more, where I'm myself is more interested is in quantum foundations, because these bases, I should tell you later what they are like analogs of the X and T variables in continuous quantum mechanics. And so, so they are complementarity variables. And also, if you have a complete set of them, you can use them for state tomography. And in relation to this, Waters has defined a discrete phase space where you can define a Wigner function as a representation for quantum states. Also, I will talk about the geometry and these states. They will sit somewhere in the set of quantum states, and it tells something about the geometry of the set of quantum states. This is the outline. I will define what it is and what I call the MUB problem, give a geometrical description, and define a distance between bases in Hilbert space, which can be used as a distance, a measure of unbiasedness. And then it will be like second part, where I will talk about Hadamard matrices, and we will look what it is like in six dimensions, where this so-called MUB problem is still unsolved. This is me, and I am now at Umeå Universitet in the northern part of Sweden. But when I wrote my thesis, I was working with Ingmar Bengtsson at Stockholm University, so I cooperated with him. And we also had cooperated with Jan-Åke Larsson. Karol Suszkowski, Wojciech Tarej, and Wojciech Gusta, colleagues in Poland. So what is this? How many of you know what mutual unbiased basis is? Okay, so most have seen this before. I should define what it is, but I will not speak so much about the definition now, so that I really can try to say the things that I've been studying about mutual unbiased spaces. First, if I have a vector f, it is unbiased with an orthonormal basis. If this expression, probability, if you would like that, is 1 over n. And n is the dimension of the Hilbert space. So this vector has the same overlap with every vector in the spaces. Usually, we don't have only one vector. We are interested when this vector is part of another orthonormal basis. So then this should be true for every vector in these spaces and in these spaces. And that this is 1 over n is just, it should be a constant, and then it turns out to be 1 over n. It should be consistent. Okay, so this is two bases that are unbiased. Often one say that they are mutual unbiased, but mutually actually means that there are several. So these are unbiased. And the set of MUBs, a set of mutual unbiased bases, is when we have a set of several such bases, which all are unbiased. And we want complete set of MABs. Then we should have n plus 1 MABs. This set of bases is complete in two different senses. One thing is that you can never have more than n plus 1 such bases. And we will see that in the geometrical description. And another thing is that if you should use these bases or the corresponding observables and do measurements to do the state determination, we need this many different observables to determine quantum state. So this we can see that if we have an observable and we measure many times, we will get n minus 1 parameters. And if we have n plus 1 bases, this is n squared minus 1, which is the dimension of quantum states. And as it is today, I think the main problem, the MAB problem, is the main problem with in this subject is if there exist complete sets. And since this rather simple question is not answered, I think this is the reason why there have been so many papers about this. Everyone tries to say something and try to see why it's difficult.
Non-existence or?
No, they have not. Because I haven't actually read all of them and I have searched for
maybe
the answer.
Not all of them have been. But there's been a large problem actually on.
A large problem has been about problem. That. And some of them have been related to other problems, and then they mentioned them also. For example, the Sieg problem that Chris is interested in. But I guess, I mean, this is. If you see that they exist, maybe there will be a bunch of papers trying to say what they are really good for. But to know, we have to see if they exist. We want them for state tomography, and the Wigner functions formulation is really nice too. Okay, so what is known? Do complete sets exist? Yes, if the dimension is a prime power. When n is prime power, there exists finite fields of the order n. And then one can use these finite fields to construct mutual unbiased spaces. And if you don't know what a finite field is, if you only have the prime case, it's only like counting modulo p. And then it's generalization when you have prime power. So what else is known? We don't know anything about the other dimensions, if we can have complete sets or not. So the lowest dimension that is open is 6 dimensions. And you might think 6 is a small number, but 6 by 6 meters is not so easy to handle. Okay. Geometrical description. Instead of looking just on these vectors, we will now look at unit trace matrices. So we have Hermitian matrices, and they have unit trace. And if these matrices are positive, they correspond to quantum states. We have a distance between these matrices, natural distance, And then I would like to have the origin instead of being the zeroth matrix, because these have not unit trace. I would like the origin to be the unit times 1 over n, maximally mixed state. And when you have the distance and the origin, we get a scalar product in these matrices. Like that. Should have a little picture here what I really mean by this. I mean, if we have this the zero matrix here, and some distance from it, this matrix will be here. And all unit trace matrices will lie in a plane here. And if I choose this to be the origin instead of this one, this plane is really a subspace. So within this subspace, I have this scalar product. And everything that is positive has to lie within a ball in this hyperplane. I mean, it's usually higher dimensional. But not everything inside here is positive, but some of them are positive within here. And on this border, in some places on this border, we have the projectors. So what does the basis look here? So normal basis. If I compute the distances, it's very, it's natural that whatever pair of states I take from the basis, the distance will be the same between them. So I have some projectors like this. And I can find that the distances between any pair is 1. So if I am in 3 dimensions, I should have 3 points with the distance 1 in between them. So that means that it would be something like this. So they will form a simplex. So base is simplex. And now this yellow hyperplane is higher dimensional, and the simplex is, in this case, only 2 dimensional. Every simplex is in a subspace of this space of unit trace operators. So that was a basis. So what is an unbiased basis? Something that fulfills this. This I can write like trace of the projector for a state in one of the bases, state in another basis, equals to 1 over n. It's the same. And then I see from the scalar product here. But if I put 1 over n here, this will be 0. Oh, it shouldn't be the same letter here. Could be just any state from the basis. So the scalar product is 0, and that means that they have to be orthogonal. So this first simplex we have here. And the next one, the unbiased basis, must lie in an orthogonal plane. Unnecessary, I don't really hear anything. In the case n equals 3, I like to draw a picture of all these mutual unbiased spaces. This is the first basis. Then in an orthogonal plane, I have a second basis. And then I have yet another one, and yet another one. So these are n plus 1 mutual unbiased spaces. And this is two dimensions, and then we have four, and then we have six, and this is eight dimensions. And eight dimensions, that is what we have for the quantum states in from the Hilbert space and Nichols tree. So now it's really clear that we can never have more than n plus one. From this picture, you can also see what you can use them for tomography. If we do a lot of measurements in these spaces, and this is simplex lying in the space of quantum states, we measure in these spaces, we will find out where in this subspace the state will lie. Here, maybe. And then we can do the same for all of these. And then we have estimated what state we have. So they can be used for tomography. Okay. Now I would like to talk about the polytope, which I call the complementarity polytope. And then I take all of these corners, and I take the convex hull, so they span a polytope. And this I can do in any dimension, whether I have quantum, whether I have maps or not, I can do this. I just take simplices and I lie them in, orthogonal planes, and I say I have a polytope here. So now the problem, if there exists a complete set of maps, is if I can take this higher dimensional polytope and fit it inside the set of density matrices. Because this polytope, every corner here will be a quantum state if it just ends up at one projector. The set of quantum states is inside some large ball, and this square has dimension n squared minus 2. But the pure states has only dimension 2n minus 2, so it's a little part of this square. Can I take this polytope and get every corner to end up somewhere on this small set? Yes?
What about dimension? It's always real dimension.
Yeah, it's real dimensions.
This is not complex. Yeah, it's never complex dimension.
So this is a real dimension.
So if you're just talking about a general construction now, that I start with a set of orthogonal planes,
mm-hmm.
I put a simplex on the inside of the inside of each plane.
Yes.
Okay. And the simplices I'm making are living in the space of Hermitian operators.
Yes.
Not necessarily the quantum states.
That's right.
And now the issue is just orienting them, orienting that thing, whatever that thing is, to fit inside of the quantum states. States.
Yeah.
That's it. Okay.
So that's the reformulation of this mathematical expression.
Okay.
N plus one base.
I remember asking you this question
before,
and I'm still confused on it. So that simplex is a unique simplex. There's no freedom left.
The simplex?
Yes. So if I construct my simplex in the way that you did, there's only one simplex of that. That shape. Excuse me. If I construct the polytope
the polytope
way you say.
Yes, that's right. So you think that if I can do something with this one, so that it's related to this one in some other way.
Yeah, I was imagining rotating them in the plane.
Okay.
And I got confused about that.
I know. Okay, it's good that you ask again. So one way to see that is that if I should describe the vectors for this sample, we stated four dimensional vectors. We tried to describe this part. We don't care about the other yet. So then I should have something here and something there, and then 0, 0, because I have decided that this point lie in in this plane spanned by the vectors 1, 0, 0, 0, and 0, 1, 0, 0. Okay, and the other ones in these spaces is described in a similar way, it's just different numbers here. And everything in these spaces should be something like that. Okay, so now if I try to rotate something here, the only thing this will correspond to is some kind of, it's equivalent to a coordinate transformation within this subspace, because these two should be orthogonal all the time. You clear? No?
I mean, I try to put some other color. I can just put some coordinates here, x and y. And then I can compute them and see that what x and y is for these points to the decimal number C and D. And then if I try to rotate it, as we'd like to do, it's just the same as rotating the coordinates. And that can never do anything to mix these numbers and end up here in some way. So they
right.
Doesn't matter.
Okay.
Yes?
Maybe it makes sense to consider an equal stimulant, and this polytope is just a particular, like, two forward illustration.
Sorry, I couldn't hear.
When you consider an equal stimulant, then the real dimensions are just three, and then the polytope is just the only difference.
Yes.
Yeah, on the block here.
We should actually draw that, so that some of the things be clearer. But on the other hand, the cubic case is very different from everything else. Okay.
Well, would it be fair to consider this as like a generalization of the block sphere of higher dimensional spaces?
Can you please repeat?
Would it be illustrative and fair to call this a generalization of the block sphere?
Yeah, the set of quantum states, I mean, it's, when you try to describe what it looks like, it's some generalization of the block sphere. That's right. And I try to get corners to really end up at the surface of this. The block square, the whole surface is fine, but higher dimensions is not. So we should have a picture of the block square here. Block ball. I can take the basis. It's spin up and spin down in the sub direction. And then I can do it in the direction. Y direction. Very messy. Yeah, is it clear what I'm drawing? Okay, so this polytope I'm talking about is, in this case, an octahedron. And here it doesn't matter how we rotate, this is where it's all pure states. And I mean, this a simplex here is only points to the line in between. So this is what a complementary polytope looks like in two dimensions. And so why do I do this? Well, we are trying to learn something about it. And there is conjecture that it's only possible in this case, because otherwise no one has managed to do anything. So then I wonder, is there something special with the polytope for these dimensions?
I can ask if there is something special with a set of density matrices, but I don't really know what I should say about that yet. But maybe I can say something about this polytope. And we have found something that we cannot really say that it's special for exactly these dimensions, but it's very likely, because we find a connection to a problem within combinatorics. So I should try to explain that, not in detail, but just to show how we use the polytop and speak of the different spaces. And I continue with three dimensions, because then I can at least draw every base from the board. Now I can pick these four corners. And then I can take the convex hull of that. So it will be like picking one side of this polytop. This is face of the polytop, which we call a point face. I denote it by alpha. And then we define an operator. By summing all of these, then we will end up on an operator that lies on a ray from the origin in this space. And we were actually guided by Waters-Wigner function definition when we did this. Okay, we take these piece projectors that lie in the phase alpha. And this can be rewritten like this. There are n raised to n plus 1 different ways to choose one point from each simplex here. So we have so many point faces.
Some face of the polyhedron? It's more complicated.
Center. No, if we really are in. I mean, these are vectors. In these simplices, I can draw the origin. The origin is the only point that they have in common in these orthogonal planes. So this is like a vector going there to this one. And then I just add these vectors together. And that will be like a vector pointing through the midpoint of this space that is spanned by these dots. Also these four dots will also span a simplex.
So the answer is yes to his question.
Is it the answer? Yes. Okay. The very center.
The very center of the face.
Of the face is what he meant.
So you mean it's really the middle, the center
yeah,
of,
yeah.
Okay. It's just that also this operator, if we don't do any normalization, will lie outside, further away.
Okay, so it goes through the very center, but it goes further.
Yeah, it goes further. Because we have these vectors, so it really goes too far away from the middle. But it's normalization. Not so important. But what you can do with this one is you can define a lot of planes, hyperplanes. This could be any matrix, but I write it all because it's interesting when we have these things connected. Trace rule A alpha and constant. This defines hyperplanes. For every constant here, this will be a plane. So here we will have a plane where all these points lie. And that's when the constant is 1.
on the other side of the polytop, we have a face containing all these projectors. And this is when the constant is zero. And in between, for everything in between, it will be something between zero and one. And this is the same as Wöhler's Wigner function that he has. How many of you have heard about the discrete Wigner function defined by Wöhler's? Okay. So some of you understand more of this and some don't. But to you who doesn't really know what it is and how it works, I can say that this was really a help for us to find this structure, what we were looking for, that he had these operators. But he doesn't have all of them. He doesn't use all of these. He only have n squared of them. And these n squared are such that these operators forms a basis in the space of all Hermitian operators. So he has somehow some of these operators turns out to be a basis. And if this is a basis for all Hermitian operators, I have now included this the zero down there. These will span, again, we have a simplex, higher dimensional simplex. This is n squared corners in the set of density matrices. In the space where the density matrix is, this is n squared minus one. So this is really a simplex, these points.
I mean, if you map them to density operators, then they'll span the space.
Span the whole space. I mean, this is really a basis in the space of.
It's an orthonormal basis.
Yes, it's also normal if I just normalize it.
Okay.
I haven't heard about that.
Okay.
And I have an M here. So it's a basis. So if I pick the right choices of these points for my complementarity polytop, the very center, should I say that? The very center will give a simplex.
I'm just confused about the statement. So Wöhler's Wigner functions are a representation of the complete set of quantum states. So there's a continuous infinity of them, no matter what the dimension. And you said he had n squared Wigner functions.
Yeah. So I was wrong. I said wrong. So that's a good point.
What did you really mean then?
For n squared alpha. I should pick. I should have n squared such operators.
Yes.
And then.
Oh, for n squared of those, that corresponds to his Wigner function.
Yes.
Okay, but otherwise it doesn't necessarily.
No, otherwise it doesn't necessarily. Thank you for your clarification. So for some of them, this is his Wigner function. Yeah, it can have different definitions. Anyway, to come to the point now is that we want to have a simplex within this polytop. And finding such a simplex, to make it short, is equivalent to finding n minus 1 orthogonal Latin squares. So these are some objects that you have in combinatorics. An example of a Latin square is if I have 1, 2, 3 here, and then I should fill this numbers in, so there is 1, 1, and 1, 2, and 1, 3 in every row and every column. So this is an example of a Latin square. So we should find something that is called orthogonal Latin squares. And this is exactly the same problem as finding finite affine plane. So this thing, we should try to find some simplex if it should somehow make some connection to this wonderful Wigner function. And we find that this problem is equivalent of finding an affine plane. And these affine planes, if they exist or not, is an open problem that have been open much longer than this problem. And almost the same is known, but a little more. We should make, do you see if I write down here? Good question.
Problem or is
yes.
It? Yes. It is.
I think so. But I don't know. I don't know definitely.
Okay.
But these kind of things have been studied very long. Do you see if I write down here?
Yes.
Because I should do similar thing here. Say if it can, if it exists or not.
Again. Yes, if. N equals pk, prime power, p raised to k. No, it actually doesn't. It's too little space. I changed my mind. They have some definite no answer for some dimensions. If the remains, if we divide by 4, is 1 or 2, these affine planes does not exist. But there is a catch. Unless n happens to be a sum of squares. And then here, we, in this case, one doesn't know again. Oh, by some really heavy computer search, really trying all possible ways to find such an affine plane. 10 dimensions is ruled out. And otherwise, it's not known. And there are people who have a conjecture that this problem here, finding the mumps, is exactly the same as finding these things. Maybe one would think that what I've done here is kind of support for this, but I actually don't think it is, because what we've done here is finding, in our polytope, we find a simplex that is related to what others have done. And this problem, finding the simplex, is equivalent to this problem. But it's not at all obvious that if we should find complete sets of maps in other dimensions, that we should do something similar that we have done up to now. I would say that we should not, because otherwise we should have found it already. So maybe this actually hints that it's not the same problem, but I don't know. And if anyone have any ideas, I would be very happy to hear about it afterwards.
If it's only for n equals 3 or something, or that this is, you can do this, can't you do this construction for any dimension of Hilbert space?
This construction?
Yeah.
I can only find a simplex. I mean, finding these bases as the barycenter of faces. I can only find such a simplex as barycenters if there exists an affine plane. Otherwise, I cannot choose the faces so that I get the syntax.
Oh. But you could have a mutually unbiased basis, but you wouldn't be able to carry out this construction.
Yes.
That's possible.
And it shouldn't be an easy way to do this linear function stuff with it.
So this end, this no result for n equals 10 doesn't disprove the existence of,
no.
of an affine, of a mug.
No, it's not. Unfortunately. It's not. Let's say something more about this protocol before we leave it. Well, I think we should not. Unless someone else has more questions on it.
I have a question, but maybe you are going to that in the second part of the talk. Isn't it easier to look at the problem in terms of subgroups or unitary matrices?
I think it's not easier, but there is exactly equivalent problems in those terms, mm-hmm. so that you could try to find a decomposition of an algebra into maximal abelian subalgebras. Mm-hmm. And this is the same problem. So there are things written about this problem before anyone thought about it with quantum mechanics. Okay, that's what you thought about, or was it something else?
I was thinking of instead of talking of a basis, talking of a unitary which collects the given basis to the other.
Oh.
Then you have a subgroup, a finite subgroup of the unitary group.
Mm-hmm.
With the properties that each matrix which is not the identity, has
this
with the
okay,
constant
this
module.
Is very, very close connected to this point.
Yeah, so
okay.
In that case, please go.
I see.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, we're glad when we said I tripped up for 1 hour and I thought this is really a lot of time. But I don't feel like that anymore. The distance, at least, goes.
Yeah, your time's up.
No, it's not. It's not. The distance. Where do I have my notes? Okay. So we have seen that a basis lying in a certain subspace, that is like plane in a higher dimension, and this is exactly what one has in Grassmannian space. Grassmannian MN planes in Rn. The Grassmannian is the space of all these planes in Rm. And in our case, m is n squared minus 1. And n is where the symplices lie, n minus 1. And there have been some studies about packing planes in these spaces by Conway, Hardin, and Sloan. And they use a distance that we thought was convenient to use also for our basis. So any basis, if I take the base with all the E vectors, I can find a projector that projects down to the subspace. And that's P. And this is a projector that projects down to another subspace. And this is a distance one can use, and probably you see that this is actually
equivalent to what we did before when we have vectors in Hilbert space, and then I took them as projectors. Then they were vectors in the space of operators instead. And here we do the same thing. We have some planes, but we can say that they are projectors. We can use a distance that is used between any symmetric matrix. And here I have a little c because it should be another distance, and because this stands for chordal. And again, it will be that projectors will lie on some square, and the distance will be like chordal distance like this. One can actually write this also in terms of angles between these planes. We'll not really explain everything here, but it could be nice to know that one can define angles between the planes and find this distance from the angles with a simple formula. So this is general for these planes. And now if we really have planes that comes from two bases in Hilbert space. Oh yes, there is more than one because you have a higher dimensional space, and you can, what you do is to see, you take one vector in one plane and one in another, and then you rotate them within the planes until the angle between them is as large as possible. And that will be your first angle. Then you take new vectors within the planes that are orthogonal, and then you find next another one because this is there will be many angles between them. Okay. So now I put in these two bases. It should be like this. Instead of writing these, I just write the vectors. So this is expression. One can see that this distance always is equal or smaller than one. And actually, it will be one only if this probability or is one over n for all pairs of vectors in these spaces. And that's exactly when they are mutually unbiased. So this could be a measure of unbiasedness. At least it's maximal only for the mutual unbiased spaces. And one can, for example, use this for numerical searches, try to find the maximum of this function, which I haven't done, but some other people have done it, and maybe I say something about it soon. Probably not. There's some board notes here. Ah. Yes. Okay. Now we should talk about these Hadamard matrices, which is related to what you asked about. We haven't seen any vectors here at all. I just talked about. I mean, we have a lot of vectors, but we haven't seen the components of them, how we can write them. But now we should take the first basis like this. These are the two vectors of the first basis. So it's just the identity. I should have something that is unbiased with all of these. It must be so that every element of this new vector that should be unbiased must have the same modulus So one example is this vector. We have the same scalar product with all of these. And we can normalize it. And then I would like to have two more so that we get a basis. And it turns out that this is a good choice. Well, actually, it's in some sense the only choice, if I start with only ones here, to have this matrix, this is a Fourier matrix. And these vectors are now orthogonal. And I call it H1. H stands for Hadamard matrix. So this is a complex Hadamard matrix. Complex Hadamard matrices are unitary matrices where all elements have the same modulus. And we see that that whenever we want to have a basis that are unbiased with this one, it should be an Hadamard matrix. And this is also the matrix one should use to find the transformation between these two. Okay, so we have two. We want yet another one. What can we do? Well, we don't have to start with 1, 1, 1. We can multiply this one with some basis. And we get another one. So we have a diagonal matrix that we multiply with. And we should choose these very carefully so that these two matrices are unbiased with each other. Well, these two bases are unbiased. And it's not so hard to see that the requirement is that this should also be an Hadamard matrix. So now we see that another way to maybe look for these initialized spaces is to look at Hadamard matrices and see if we can find the such that this product of them is again an Hadamard matrix. And in three dimensions, you can do that. You will have the H2 and you will have yet another one here. Because it's possible to solve it in three dimensions. But what about six dimensions? And I will take a few more minutes to say a little bit. And now I would like to have the screen down. I wonder if this should go on or if I should do something. Okay. Here we have a list of six-dimensional Hadamard matrices that are known. In lower dimensions, you essentially only have this one if you would like to start with 1, 1, 1. But here I have something that is similar, the Fourier matrix, but one can add in some of the elements these spaces too. There is a matrix that is cyclic. Here. Come after a while. Okay, so this is similar to the lower dimensions when it works, and this Fourier matrix is used in the standard constructions when you can have a complete set. There is some kind of cyclic matrix that it contains plus minus one, plus minus I, and then here's some kind of magical number fit in some places to make it really a unitary matrix. Beta has found some family of matrices. You also can have some extra faces here. There is spectral matrix. This is only built up from third rules of unity. And this was found quite recently. Otherwise, one should think that maybe it's easy to find it, but it's not so easy, really. We have a family of Hermitian matrices. It says that they are non-affine, and it's because this parameter you have, you cannot fit it in like in a face like this. It's more complicated. And we have the symmetric ones. The symmetric ones was fine last year, these ones 2 years ago. And I think, therefore, that there might be even more, because new ones are fine when people have been looking. So somewhere from this set, we should look for mutual unbiased spaces. Gressel has made some work where he find out that if we start with this Fourier matrix, take one, we take the Fourier matrix, and then here, there are 16 possibilities. But none of these are unbiased with each other. So you can never have more than three if you use Fourier matrix.
I got lists of him,
what they look like. Because I wondered, I mean, there must be something on this list here. So what was it really that he got from his computer program? And it was six pages like this. Oh, I should put it like this. It doesn't really matter. Yeah, he used Magma. So this is what I got.
This is why we need Magma PI.
And except for the handwriting, it's my good writing. I really see that it fits with this list. So the matrices he has is something like Fourier and something with a sequence matrix.
And we realized after a while when we talked to a retired lecturer at Stockholm University Math Department that this is really related to B unimodular sequences. And after a while, we realized that he was actually working with compute algebra programs. And he had studied this as something as a problem to study, to try out his program. And he had actually found this same thing that Gressel had found with Magma earlier, just that we didn't understand that you could get maps from it. So we have looked at this structure and the distances between them, and I would
take one of them to be the identity, one of them to be the Fourier matrix, then Gressel has classified all possibilities for the third one.
Yes.
And within those, none of them are have the right inner product.
Yes.
So the product of two of them is not yet another Hadamard.
Mm-hmm.
I see. Okay. So all it rules out is that you shouldn't take your two starting matrices as the identity and the Fourier.
You should not start with this one. It's not really. This happens also in four dimensions, and where you have a. I don't know if. It's
so in the known constructions in four dimensions, one of them is not the Fourier matrix. Okay.
So this is seen before, that when you have a prime power. This might not be included, to get a full one. Anyway, what we did was to do some more searches and
to make it really short, I should only tell you that after a while, we realized that this is what was known that Gressel had done 3 months. And there could be different ones here. We find out, I should type some of them. We find out that it's possible actually to use other matrices to get triplets. And there could be several of this third one. And as Chris just asked, I mean, third one, they cannot be mutually unbiased with each other. But we haven't outruled that there are no other ones. So we don't know, unfortunately, this can be
extend it. There comes up that there is some other number C here that is also not just some simple unit root that one can use. And there are some other sets we see that we can use at least different matrices. But nowhere we have got more than three. So the only result I would say is that at least one doesn't have to follow the standard rule, do something that is very similar to this Fourier matrix. But there are other possibilities. And even if we haven't found more, I'm not convinced that there are no other possibilities. Okay. I defined a non-polytope and I found some connection with alpine planes.
I cannot really say anything about the existence of complete sets of maps, but it's very interesting anyway to see that you can find this structure within this non-polytope. And I hope one can go on with this and do something more. We have distance that can be used for a measure of unbiasedness. So these different ones, we have checked the distance between them, so you can see if you want to have a fourth one, and it wanted to be almost mutual unbiased, you can find with this distance which one is the best to take. MAMs can be described as set of Hadamard matrices that are unbiased. You can understand what matrices that turns up together with the Fourier matrix. If you study so-called B unimodular sequences, that has to do with the Fourier transform. And there are inequivalent triplets of models. Thank you.
Questions?
Yes.
Yeah?
Okay, go. Let me see you.
I'm still puzzled about the question posed in the middle of your talk. One could try to formulate on this as the search for a finite subgroup of the group of unitaries of order n with some algebraic properties. But is it possible to formulate as an algebraic problem the problem that these unitaries acting on a fixed base give you a maximal set of unbiased bases?
Oh.
This will be very nice.
You mean these ones I look for, I should try to find them as a subgroup?
As a subgroup of UN with some algebraic properties.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe there should be some property related to the symmetric group, because I suppose if you act with the symmetric group, you get another set. Can it be globally stable? Can this subgroup be normalized? I think there would be a lot of algebraic properties which could be a translation of your problem. But I wonder whether it is possible to set down as pure algebraic properties of a subgroup, a maximal finite subgroup of UN, which corresponds to your problem.
My guess is that it's not possible. But I have to think more about it to be sure. But these Hadamard matrices that you find that are unbiased with each other, I cannot see that they should be part of a subgroup.
Well, if you take as unitaries, the units connect one base to another.
Yeah? Is this what?
Maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to me that it should form a group. Because if you combine two of them, you get just one, just change the name of your.
And you get the next one.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, you're right. That's why this is also part of our matrix.
So if they form a group,
okay,
so
we should have a finite this one, and then we have one, and we combine with the next one. But this new one is not unbiased. What should I say? This new one that we get when we take this product is not unbiased. The other one necessarily.
So there will not be a group, you say?
Well, then it shouldn't be.
is not a group, then my question for staff is probably not so nice.
I'm a bit confused, but I think it could be hard.
Okay, you could still ask for a maximum subset of your group, but if it's not a group yourself, it's probably not that helpful.
I think in the known constructions, it is the case that one can start with a single basis and then act with a single unitary to generate the next one, and then the squared unitary to generate the third one, and the fourth one, and the fifth one, but not all the way. Mm-hmm. There's one left always. So you get D of them by this method, and then the extra one is not generated in.
You mean you think all of the known ones are left?
Well, at least I think you can always translate this is a result of Appleby's, that you can perform a unitary on all of the known constructions so that you find this. So
I have seen this for the qubit, but not anything else. Okay.
Yeah, I believe it's general. In prime dimensions, at least. In non-prime
dimensions. Non-prime probably.
Non-prime, I don't know, but in prime dimensions.
You need several sets.
Yeah.
For
I don't know anything about non-prime, but okay. In prime dimensions, I believe Appleby, I'm fairly confident that Appleby is showing this, that you can get D of them in this nice simple method, but to get the last one.
What if you keep going beyond the these ones? Do you come back to the first, or do you just get other ones that are numbered?
I'm not sure. Oh, yeah, I could dig up the note.
If you came back, you'd have to see if it's up a little bit anyway. Mm-hmm.
Yes, the question was, it isn't.
It's a different question. It's a different question.
Okay.
So did I understand, when you talked about those planes, it's actually enough to find the planes. You don't have to find the specific basis. Is that the implication of what you were saying? If you find all these planes with the right distance between them, then from that you can get a mub.
If the planes...
I mean, if I understood, you get the planes from the mub, but you can't return back. I mean, from the basis you get a plane.
Yeah, but from a plane I don't
you can't
know
return
the
back uniquely.
No, that's right. Because there is only some of the planes where there is only, if we have the three dimensions again, if I take one of these planes, somewhere inside here we have common space, but there is only very few planes that are such that it happens to be a basis line here.
But if you get one of those, can you tell us you have one of those planes without finding the basis? In other words, is the whole problem reduced to a problem for finding certain types of planes? Because you have
certain
equivalences.
So you mean that I should look for these planes and then can I say something else? What the plane should be like to contain such a basis?
Yeah. I thought that was your intention to show how you could reformulate the whole problem in terms of looking for certain kinds of planes.
Well, if you have such planes, that it's again, I mean, what I really need is that these are positive operators, well, they are projectors. So I need to have a projector spanning the simplex. And no, I don't know any other way to get it.
I see. So it's not, I mean, when you talked about the affine plane of order n, I had the impression that if you found one, then you could get a mub. Was that wrong? I mean, if you could find an affine plane
no.
of the right order, then you
no.
would have a mub.
We doesn't even know if we could find a mub if we have an affine plane.
There's just some...
If we have an affine plane that is coordinated with a field, we get a mub. But there could be affine planes that are not related to... the fields.
So these are all just sort of
no
related.
One knows what it is.
They're all related problems, but they're not exactly
no.
logically equivalent problems.
They are not.
Not that anyone has shown. Some people feel
that they should
feel that they should be, but no one has shown.
I want a different sort of question. Uh-huh. Suppose you prove that, say, you cannot find MUBs in any dimension other than a prime power. Mm-hmm. Would that have any consequences? You know, like, for, I don't know. If it, would a quantum, for instance, well, if a quantum foundation says,
I think
therefore now I understand something like this.
Well, I'm not really sure what you should say that it means that you can have a complete set. What does it mean that we have many, what can we do if we have many complementary bases, and what can we do if we have fewer? So one thing that is not possible is to use some tomography. And it's been proven that if you use polynomial measurements for tomography, this is the optimal way. So if we don't can do it, there must be something else. What is then the optimal? We don't really know what it should look like. There is not even, I don't think there is even, what should I say? Like a protocol, no way to just, in any dimension, write down a set of bases that you can use for this tomography instead. And also you can use several of them for cryptography and get safer cryptography if you have many. Instead of just using two bases, you can have three or four and several of them. But also there, I'm not really sure if it matters what dimension and how many if it's complete. But I think I have studied the geometry of the set of quantum states, which I think is interesting. And this would tell me at least something about what this geometry is like and how it varies if you have different dimensions.
My only question was a variation of that one, because I keep asking, Wouters has been studying this problem for 23 years, I think. And so I have asked a variation of this. Suppose we find that a complete set doesn't exist in dimension 6, what have we learned? And Wouters' answer is almost always the same every time I ask it.
Uh-huh.
Every 3 years.
So what is it?
He says that we'll learn that God likes prime powers, and he doesn't like numbers that are not of that form. but then I ask, but really we want to know why God doesn't like those numbers, and it would be nice to know how this program would reveal something like that. And I guess you don't really know the answer of how it would tell us the why answer.
No. But it's a problem that
in your PhD defense, you did make a point that this helps us understand the idea of complementarity, ultimately. But I don't recall what you said.
You mean I said that it really makes us understand it?
It was one of these things like Bohr would have said, you know, it felt good for a moment.
I don't remember I ever seen that this really helps us understand complementarity. But there was a complementarity. And what I've seen from quantum mechanics is that complementarity somehow is a basic thing. From the complementarity we get a lot of other stuff that seems strange within quantum mechanics. It doesn't have any classical mechanics, so it's one of the basic things that we.
So returning to a technical question, I guess in principle, if they don't exist, you could rule out by just a computer search. But I suppose it's completely beyond the capability of any computer.
Yeah.
You're just in too high of a dimensional space. You can't
rule out that they don't exist.
No, sorry. Rule out that they do exist. If they don't exist, you should be able to prove it by covering the whole space with little balls of a certain size and showing that
at least
a certain distance from any model.
I'm very, very bad on this point. But one thing is that, I mean, rest of this thing. and it was enough for him, and he thought that you can't do much with magma. And then I've been working with Jan-Åke Larsson, and he had done some numerical searches when we were looking at this problem. So some of these sets I had before, we found from his computer search. And he really tried to build it, having some balls and trying to cover the space. And it was really, really hard. He said that whenever he tried to change the lattice he used, there were always somewhere some obstacle that he couldn't make it. So even if he would have computer going for forever, he hadn't really found a way that could solve this problem. By making some, as you said, trying to cover the space in this way. But I didn't really understand it. I still hope he will come with some results, because one is still going on trying.
Well, I mean, if the answer is no, then every point in that space is some finite distance from any mug. I mean, we have to be moved by a certain minimal distance epsilon to be a mug. And you could just show that there are no points, that every point is within epsilon over 2 of a point. I mean, I'm not saying it well, but there's some way in which you could, if there is no mug, you could prove it in principle by a search like that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I guess so too. But
then what about in the opposite direction, in the positive direction? If people look, you know, do some sort of just search, you know, simulated annealing or some sort of thing that would try and narrow in on them, as they've done that?
I'm not sure I understood what you say, but I can say one thing that has been done. I have this distance here, yeah. You want to maximize it, and if you take this part,
try to maximize.
You want to minimize it, and then you take the sum over all pairs from all these 7 potential bases, and then you do some, try to minimize it, and see if you can get 0. Mm-hmm. And this has been done by and they didn't reach, they reached 0 when they did it in 5 dimensions, for example, where you can do it. And they didn't do it in 6 dimensions. If they tried by 7 bases, it was quite bad. If they had only 4, they got a little better. But still, they didn't reach 0. But this is not so extensive.
I mean, they did 3. They did achieve something very close to 0.
Yeah, it was rather close, but it's it's 0. Something. You have it in the book.
When there are 3 bases.
But when there is 4 bases, maybe we said 2.
Yeah, but with 3, they definitely got 0.
Oh, with 3 bases, they got 0.
Okay.
And then they just rather close. But how much this is doesn't, I mean, we have a measure now, but you can only compare different sets. It doesn't say anything really about what health it is. Then we have to understand what this means in some operational meaning.
I think also.
But what they did here, I think still that it was, I mean, also in, let me see. In 7 dimensions, they had some problem, and then we know that they exist. I think it was that, or if it was some higher. I shouldn't say more because I don't know exactly how it is now, but I think that its structure is very different in 6 dimensions than it is in 5 dimensions. There could be many local minima where you get stuck. So, yes.
So I think Smolin, John Smolin, mm-hmm. has also studied it numerically.
Okay.
And he easily finds numerical solutions in dimensions up to 6, and then at 6 it stops. And I believe that Reinhard Werner also has.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of people have studied it numerically. They don't appear.
You know, there's something else that goes on. I can't believe there's any connection, but if you try and embed a binomial causal set in Minkowski space of an arbitrary dimension, it works up to 6. It stops in 6. It's still not proven that you can't do it in 6.
Well, why don't we thank Osa?